Welcome to Dr. Hustle, the podcast where we interview physicians and health professionals who are living at the crossroads of innovation as leaders, entrepreneurs, and artists. Our mission is to showcase the insights and skills that can help you discover the creative and leadership potential within yourself. Here's your host, Bassam Zahid.
Hey listeners, my name is Bassam Zahid, and welcome to episode 7. When Adam Grant, the author of the book Give and Take, and professor at the Wharton School of Business, defined givers as someone who strives to be generous in sharing their time, energy, knowledge, and skills with other people who might benefit from them, he must have been talking about today's guest, Dr. Amitha Kalichandran. She's a pediatric resident and health journalist who has written for publications like the New York Times, the Walrus, the Advocate, the Boston Globe, ABC News, and the Huffington Post. She also served as a fellow in global journalism at the Monk School of Global Affairs. In addition, this multi-talented woman has launched a startup, trained as a yoga instructor, and holds a master's in public health. She even published a children's book. True to being a giver, she shared her time with me by meeting me at a bookstore in New York City to drop knowledge on how she became a writer, how she crafts her stories, and where she believes the future of medicine lies. I felt inspired after our conversation, and I bet you will too. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
In addition to being a resident in pediatrics, you're also a freelance journalist.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm also actually an amateur detective. One thing I discovered was your application video to the Monk School of Global Affairs. actually, the video.
I thought that was private. I didn't think that was
it's out there.
Public. Okay. So definitely on my to-do list to take that down.
Where were you filming that video?
So I was actually filming that in Morocco.
In Morocco?
Yeah.
Because the ground is all rocky and you're like barely keeping your balance?
No, exactly. Yeah, it's a fuzzy video and it was taken on an iPhone.
But it worked.
Yep.
Tell us about your path into journalism. You kind of started in medicine, you also have a public health background. So why also journalism?
Yeah, so journalism really appealed to me for a bunch of different reasons. I mean, I was always interested in writing. And I always tell people that are in medicine that journalism and medicine are actually very similar. Most people think that they're two completely different fields, but they're both very analytical. And doctors start with a question, right? Usually the question is, what is the diagnosis, or what could these symptoms be pointing to? Journalists do the same thing. They take information and try to figure out what the truth is. We just do different things with that information. So I reached a point where, so I was in residency. I was pretty burnt out. And I was just looking for things that would keep me curious, keep me engaged. And journalism was one of those things, and it was a way to explore questions that I had, and it's a great way to talk to really interesting people about what they're doing and write about it and reflect on it. So that, in a nutshell, that's what drew me to journalism.
And I think that's a different path than most people are taking, at least physicians, when it comes to writing. Because you'll have, you know, now that we know all about Oliver Sacks and Atul Gawande and Danielle Ofri, a lot of times people want to write, you know, the personal thing, like how did medicine change me, or how I learned to see patients better. But you're actually going the journalism route. What makes journalism different than other ways of writing?
So I think there's a lot of similarities. I think you point to something really important, that there tends to be two different paths that most quote-unquote doctor writers take. One is the memoirist or the essayist that tends to be very personal. So obviously Atul Gawande, Sandeep Jauhar, you know, there's a lot of people that have written medical memoirs. It's, you know, it's even a category in most bookstores, actually. And then there's the other side, which is the medical journalist. So, you know, Sanjay Gupta, for example. Those are the two sides of the spectrum that most people think about. And I don't think they necessarily have to be mutually exclusive. People like Atul Gawande have written journalistic types of pieces that have had really very little to do with their own personal life. But for me, I think at this stage in my life, I'm more interested in the journalism aspect because I just have a lot of questions about the world and I just have a lot of different interests. And And just the opportunity to speak to experts about different areas of health and medicine is more appealing to me than just writing about myself. Though I'm at a point where I'm starting to see that some of my interests are overlapping with some of my own experiences. So I'll definitely be exploring more medical memoir type of writing as I move forward.
And you spent a year as a global journalist fellow at the Monk School of Global Affairs.
Yeah.
How do you think that prepared you versus the alternate path of not going through a fellowship program?
Mm-hmm. So my experience in the program was great because I really came in not really knowing what to expect. And that program was very different from traditional journalism school, for example, where from what I've heard from journalist friends, there's a lot of emphasis on the theory, whereas this is very practical from the outset. So within the first week, we learned the basics of how to put together a pitch, and then we learned the basics about podcasting. Everything was just very practical. And I loved the community and the people that I met too, and just the opportunity to get mentorship and real-time feedback on stories. So we were writing and pitching stories within the first couple of weeks, whereas most traditional journalism schools, it takes several months to get to that stage. That said, I don't think everybody needs to go to journalism school, or not everybody needs to do a journalism fellowship. I think there's lots of great resources online. I think if you find mentors or a community of people that write, that can be as valuable, if not more valuable, than anything formal. And it obviously also depends on your learning style. Some people do much better in a traditional academic environment. Other people are much more freewheeling and are self-taught.
So let's actually get to the craft of writing a story.
Mm-hmm.
How do you decide when a story is worth pursuing?
I think this gets to how do you find good story ideas? So for me, my ideas come from pretty much anywhere. More often than not, they come from a random conversation that I have with a friend. So anything that makes you go, oh, I've never thought about it that way before, or you hear about a new trend that's happening and you want to explore it more. That's usually when I start thinking about it. And then I get to a research phase where I might look up articles on Medline, for example, and say, okay, is this something that people are researching? And a lot of the time I don't really get anywhere past that. But then when I do, that's when I usually pursue the story. And often I might have ideas that I feel aren't really ripe yet. So I'm curious about it, but it isn't quite ready for a pitch or a story. So I might just create a folder and gather information. And every time I see an article that talks about that general topic, I'll save that. And then it might be many months before I pitch.
But do you start working on a story before you even pitch it?
Yeah. So in any good pitch, you need to have a little bit of information. You need to know what the issue is, where the tension is. So most good stories have tension where, typically there's at least two different schools of thought. And then most stories need to have a character. So it really depends on the type of story. If you're writing a 500-word story that's very much a who, what, when, how, where kind of thing, then that's very different. But if it's a long-form story, you want to have characters. And it takes time to find good characters. So it really depends on the type of story that you're pitching in terms of how much work goes into it. And it's a balance because you don't want to be spending all this time on a pitch that might not get picked up.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you want enough information that's going to intrigue an editor.
And did you always enjoy writing?
Yeah, I did. So I used to write a lot before med school, just essays and poetry and that kind of thing. A lot of it wasn't published. And then, actually, I should say before public health school. And then it sort of faded away. I wrote a little bit in public health school. But then in med school, I think I just, as you know, there's just so much information to keep on top of. And to be honest, I think I even lost the ability to write a good sentence because you're just not using that part of your brain, And so just like any skill, if you're not using it, you're going to lose it. And then in my last year of med school, we had this program called the Portfolio Program, which is something that a lot of medical schools have now, which is like a narrative medicine type of program where you meet once. I think we met once a month as a group, it would be like six or seven med students and an attending or something. And we'd each read out like a reflective piece that relates to a patient encounter of some kind. And that's when I got back into it. So that was sort of where it got reignited, and then with a series of different experiences that I had and going to do this journalism thing is when I really started exploring it more. And before I did the journalism fellowship, I was writing for the Huffington Post, so that was a way to get back into writing again. And one of the things that I advise people to do is just write. Doesn't matter if it's crappy, it's just write, because you just need to use that muscle and get used to formulating an argument and get used to writing clearly. And the only way you can do that is with practice. So the Huffington Post is a really great way to do that. And my articles range in quality very clearly from that. But at the same time, it was something that just kept me writing.
And actually, for the Huffington Post, you wrote a post called Why I Write, My Autobiography. And you gave four reasons why you write. You said to offer a different perspective, because you're not an expert, to discuss three childhood health epidemics, and to teach and to learn. Do you think those reasons have changed as you've kind of evolved as a writer?
Yeah, I think they have. I think the second point about to write about those three points has definitely expanded, because I think initially when I was writing for Huffington Post, I was very focused on childhood-related issues, which is still an interest of mine, but I've definitely expanded from that. But I think the other reasons they're still applicable.
As you started with Huffington Post as an entry point into writing, how did you even get their attention? Like, how did you even pitch an article, you know, you're trying to write just to get in the game? What kind of things did you do to get picked up?
It was interesting. So this was Huffington Post Canada. So I think that was one thing that was a little different, because they had just started. I think they'd only been in Canada for a year or something. So that was, I guess they were looking for contributors. And they actually had an open pitch call. And I think it was in like October or something like that, of whatever year I started. I think it was 2014. And so I ended up writing about Remembrance Day, which is a day that we celebrate in Canada, which is basically like Veterans Day. I think it's on the same day, but I'm not sure. And so it had nothing to do with health, but it was just a reflective piece on Remembrance Day. And they were interested. So they ran it, and for the Huffington Post, once you get something accepted, then you just become on their contributors list, and you effectively can write anything, for better or for worse. They've changed their model now, where they don't have free contributors anymore, at least from what I understand. But at the time, it was a great way to build a platform and to force myself to write, to put the pen to paper, basically. Yeah.
And speaking of pen to paper, tell us about your writing process.
Mm-hmm.
Are you writing pen to paper, or are you doing things on the computer?
Yeah, I can't. I mean, my handwriting is horrible, so I can't write pen to paper. But yeah, so it's definitely all on the computer. It really starts with, you know, again, what I was saying with like idea generation, like a random idea, and I might work it out in my head usually. And then when I feel like it's ready to write out, then I'll start with, I usually don't start with an outline unless it's a really long form piece. And then I'll just write my ideas down, and then I'll try to, I guess, sculpt it so that it makes sense structurally at the end. And then in terms of, you know, obviously part of that involves research, part of that involves identifying sources, interviewing them, and then including that in the final product. And really, it starts with the idea, and then it's only when you interview sources that you figure out what the actual issue is, or where the tension is. And 9 times out of 10, the story that you think you're going to write is significantly different. Or even if it's, you know, you think one way and you haven't really considered all these other perspectives, by speaking to a number of different sources, you can include all of those other perspectives. So the story becomes really different.
And how do you pitch your articles? Is it usually a cold email if it's like a new publication?
Yeah.
Are you putting together a portfolio for people? Are you doing a resume?
So when I did my journalism fellowship, I had no idea what a pitch was. So we learned the basics of what a pitch is. And we learned a very specific way to pitch, which I don't actually use that structure now. But the reason that it was helpful at the time is because my fellowship had an agreement with a variety of different news organizations, primarily in Canada, because that's where the fellowship was. So everyone in the fellowship basically built a portfolio. And this is the same thing with most journalism schools, like whether it's Columbia Journalism or wherever, they have agreements with different places that they'll produce things so they can build a portfolio. So through that, I built a relationship with a few editors, mostly in Canada. So I'd continue to pitch them. And then I would cold pitch, but cold pitch meaning like I'd look up the editor. I'd be very familiar with, you know, the types of articles that they write. And since my beat is obviously health and medicine, you know, the types of health and medicine articles they write or they print, I should say. And then I would email them with a brief background of me and then the pitch and, you know, let me know if this would be a good fit kind of thing. And because I had a portfolio, they could then click on, you know, I have a Contently portfolio, which is like a free portfolio that a lot of freelancers use, that just lists all my articles. So I'd hyperlink to that and they can click through and see what types of things that I've written in the past. And then kind of just wait. Usually you'd hear back within 1 or 2 weeks. And that's how you do it. Yeah. But there's lots of places that I pitched to and don't hear anything back from. And there's a whole host of reasons for that, but that's also part of the process.
Right. You just got to put things out there.
Yeah.
And actually, you tweet a lot about Adam Grant.
Mm-hmm.
And he's an interesting guy because he says two things about creativity. And mm-hmm. I'm kind of curious about your philosophy on creativity. He says the great artists are great not just because they're technically great, because mm-hmm. a lot of times you have a lot of artists who are technically great, but it's because they produce more than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And he also says that oftentimes artists can't tell whether their work is good or bad. Something they think is good might actually, the public will reject it, but something that they think is terrible, the mm-hmm. public might love it. So what do you think about creativity? And two, do you think the writing process is similar or like also applicable?
So I think two things. So I think the first point that you mentioned or Adam Grant mentioned is, I guess, the whole part of volume. Like mm-hmm. if you produce more, at some point you're going to, you know,
get a hit.
Yeah, you're going to get a hit. And I think that's definitely true. And so that goes with things like pitches, for example. It's like, you know, for every story that I write, I probably have pitched, you know, I could have pitched that exact story to three to five other outlets maybe. And I probably had 4 or 5 other ideas around that same time that I just couldn't, you know, that maybe I pursued, but I only got to a certain point and it wasn't really a story. It's sort of like the more you get those wheels spinning creatively, the easier it is to refine the process, I guess. Yeah, so I think that volume makes a difference to a certain point. I mean, you also need to balance it with, like, if you've got an idea every 2 seconds, like, you're not really going to be able to... You need to be able to discern, to some degree, a very mediocre idea from, like, you know, a good to great idea, right? And that takes time. That takes refining. And that's where conversations with, you know, peers help, you know, like, what do you think about this? Does this interest you, or is it just me? You know, because the other thing to think about with stories is that all of us have our own personal and private interests, right? Which is great, because that's what fuels you. But when it comes to stories, which are for public consumption, you know, unless you want to be writing for, like, some very, very niche magazine on, like, aerospace dynamics or something like that, you know, if you want to have widespread appeal, people need to know why it matters. So I have this quote, I don't remember who it's by, interestingly enough, but I have this quote on a post-it by my computer, which it reads, why should anyone care about this, right? And that's something, like, it's like a mantra. Like, I know it sounds really negative, but really it's important to think, does anyone else really care about this, or is it just me?
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to get really good at that. So it's a very long-winded way of saying, I definitely agree with what Adam Grant says, and definitely over time you need to get a better sense of the difference between good, or I would even say just mediocre, and good, and from good to great. And that takes time and refining, and it also takes a lot of humility, because most of us think our ideas are great. if you have confidence in yourself, you know, and so to be able to get critical and constructive feedback and take it, and it doesn't mean it means the idea is not good. If you hear negative feedback, it just means you need to refine it, or you need to find a different angle.
So you wrote an article about forest bathing, basically an idea on the benefits of being in nature, and you wrote it for the New York Times. At some point in the article, you write about meeting a physician trained in forest therapy in Japan. So besides the idea that forest bathing is interesting in itself, mm-hmm. my question is about the journalism. Did you just fly there to talk to him, or were you in Japan looking for a story? And then you decided to meet with him.
Yeah. So I was just in Japan. So I was, I had always wanted to visit Japan, so I had time and I said, you know what, I'm just going to go. But I think that it just so happened that I met someone there that was doing this interesting work, and I had read about it before. It wasn't like this groundbreaking thing. I think people have written about this before, but I think I was interested in exploring it a little bit deeper. And I feel like the people that had written about it in the past had written about it from different angles and maybe didn't have a medical perspective or didn't maybe look at the evidence base in the way that I had envisioned. So that's essentially why I did it. And I think that's, it's nice if you have the opportunity to travel as well, to try to figure out, you know, because most people that travel are curious about different cultures and different norms, especially like, you know, in health and medicine, for example, there's so much about the human body, obviously, that's universal, right? But there's so many healthcare practices that are so different, whether it's the difference between traditional and conventional or whatever it is, or different beliefs. And I think that there's interesting tension there that's worth exploring when you travel. And it's easy, it's different, it's fresh, and you know, it's only an extension from just a conversation that you might have with someone from a different culture to figuring out, okay, is this something that people would be interested in reading about?
So, and what I like about it is that, so you were there, you found this idea and then you pursued it right away rather than waiting on it.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't as much discerning there. So what made you feel, all right, this is something worth it?
I think because of the research. I think I had read papers, I think around that time when I had done the interviews, I think there was a series of papers that had come out that were sort of all over the place. So there were some papers that said, you know, there's forest bathing improves blood pressure, and then there's others that show that it really didn't. And I also noticed that it was becoming a trend programmatically, which I think is always a good sign in terms of, most of us are familiar with Malcolm Gladwell's book, Tipping Point, right? So when an idea takes hold, and that's, I think, when the best stories can kind of be told. It's like, okay, you're seeing this trend, and it's one thing when someone is researching it, and then when there's a jump between the research and the knowledge translation, and then from the and journalism and storytelling is part of that knowledge translation. But then when it jumps to like policy or programs, then that means that more people care about it and more people are going to be exposed to it. And because there were some programs, I think I talk about a program in Atlanta and then a program in Oakland, UCSF Oakland Children's Hospital, where they're actually starting to implement this formally, and by, you know, and physicians are involved. It's not some, you know, kind of alternative type of practitioner. Not that there's necessarily anything wrong with that, but I think it's always interesting when people in medicine are exploring this and are looking at the evidence for it. So it just felt like all of those dimensions intersected.
Mm-hmm. One of your pieces that I enjoyed the most, because I am partial to long-form journalism, is Losing Connor's Mind for Atavist Magazine, which got second place in 2017, Awards for Excellence in Healthcare Journalism.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the story and the process of reporting the story?
Mm-hmm. So this is a really interesting story. I think it's probably one of the stories I'm most proud of to date. And it really happened quite organically. So I knew that I wanted to do a long-form piece. And I knew that I wanted to write about something that's related to pediatrics, because that's my residency. And I hadn't really dug deep into something that was very pediatrics related, like pediatric medicine related. So I knew that off the bat, you know, and then I kind of went through my, you know, in my mind, like what are some interesting new developments in pediatric medicine, you know, and what's a counterintuitive disease, right? So any story, in my view, any story that presents a counterintuitive approach, I find to be most compelling. So a story that you go in thinking one thing and then you leave thinking something else. And I feel like the same thing in medicine. Like there's certain things in pediatrics that are unusual. You know, generally speaking, children are resilient. Generally speaking, you know, they develop forwards, not backwards. So something that relates to a counterintuitive concept in that sense I felt would be compelling. So the overall concept of childhood regression or childhood dementia is interesting. It's rare. But I knew that overall I kind of wanted to touch on something that related to that. And so, you know, I ended up just doing a bunch of, you know, research on PubMed and trying to see, like, what diseases sort of fall into that category and also meet the criteria of, like, something happening right now that's changing.
You thought that almost like that Benjamin Button idea going backwards first, mm-hmm. and then you were like, let me see what's out there?
Yeah.
So it wasn't that you, like, found the study and then that came to your head?
I mean, it's hard to say because I just read so much that I don't know if maybe I read something and it subconsciously was in my mind. Mm-hmm. It's very possible that it did. But diseases like, so in children, in female children, there's a disease called Rett syndrome, which is a disease that affects females typically. And they develop normally and then they start losing language and all that kind of thing. And that was a disease that just always fascinated me. Like it's always one of those things which just seems so unfair and so... You know, so I thought about that disease, but I knew that I didn't really want to write about that disease because nothing has really changed in the management of that disease. So that's when I started, you know, doing research on Medline and learned a little bit about, you know, this group of diseases called like the NCL diseases, which involve regression. Like it's basically like a form of childhood dementia. And so I actually ended up emailing one of the study authors. So there was a review that was published in the spring of last year looking at all of these diseases. And I emailed him. I said, you know, what's new? And this is a guy. His name is Dr. Alfred Kohlschweiter, and he's based in Hamburg, Germany. He's like one of the world experts in these diseases. And he said, you know, what's actually new is the FDA is, you know, about to approve this new enzyme replacement. And so that got the ball rolling. And then he put me in touch with a doctor in the U.S. because I knew that obviously I couldn't. I mean, I could write about a German physician, but really it needed to have, for an American outlet, which I was going to be pitching, it needed to have American characters. Then I reached out to her, and then we chatted, and then she put me in touch with, you know, a patient. So it really happened organically, and a lot of things just fell into place.
So when you were emailing this expert in Germany, were you just like, hey, I'm looking for a story? Like, my name is, you know, so-and-so, I'm a journalist? Or were you like, you know, were you just saying what's new, you know?
Yeah. So I told him that I was interested in exploring this group of diseases for a story. But I couldn't quite find the edge, was basically what I said. Right. I don't know exactly what words I used. I think having a medical background helped, for sure. Because I could say, look, I understand some of the science, I've read about it. And I think that it could make for an important story, but there needs to be something new, right? And so I think that appealed to him. Because you have to remember, like, most researchers, whether they're working in a lab or clinical researchers, like, one of the best things that can happen to them is a story that talks about their work, right? Which was also one of the most fun parts of writing that story, was really speaking to all these experts who'd really worked from, you know, some of them have worked on this specific disease, which is called CLN2. And for any listeners, it's, you know, part of Batten disease. Batten disease is a colloquial term where basically, you know, in CLN2 specifically, there's an enzyme that builds up in the brain that basically prevents normal brain function. Essentially, you can imagine like a kitchen building up garbage and no one's taking the garbage out. So eventually you just can't use the kitchen, right? So then eventually the parts of the brain don't work and child stops speaking, stops walking, you know, and then they die typically before the second decade of life. So there's been scientists that have been working on this disease for decades, you know, mouse models, dog models, clinical, you know, from the clinical trial perspective. And most of them don't really know each other, right? Because they're all siloed. And so it was great to be able to speak to them. And then they all really, at least they told me, they really enjoyed the final piece because you could see sort of where all the pieces fit together. And it's very rare, even now, for a scientist to start working on something at the lab level, like at the mouse model level, and then in their lifetime to see it result in a real clinical treatment that can affect and impact the lives of real people, right?
Now, how did you find Connor and his family?
So I found him and his family through Dr. De Los Reyes. So Dr. De Los Reyes is the doctor that Dr. Kohlschweiter introduced me to. So when I spoke to her, you know, she was the one that really ran the American, I guess, arm of the trial for this enzyme replacement therapy. So I knew that she was going to be a character, a major character in the story. And she also had her own really interesting backstory. You know, I asked her, you know, do you have a patient in mind that would be a good character? And I had another set of criteria that I needed, which was that they needed to be relatively close for me to drive to from Toronto. So that's where I was based.
Because you drove to Maryland.
Yeah.
That's like how many hours? Like
I think it's
hours?
Like, yeah, it's a while. I stayed with a friend of mine who lived in near D.C. So I drove down, stayed at hers, and then
But it's almost like the idea that if you're following a story, you need to be committed to it. You need to really believe in it to be able to
exactly.
make that kind of sacrifice.
And I felt that I was. And at that point, the pitch had been picked up, but I had spoken to the mom on the phone. So it wasn't like I had driven there not having any idea if the pitch was going to be picked up. Because, A, I felt like given the type of story and given what I was asking of the family, which was to spend that time with me and to tell me his life story, I only felt like it would be fair to really do that when I had a guarantee of where it would be published, right? Because a lot of time, it's a lot of emotion. But we were able to have a couple of initial phone conversations, you know, 30 minutes or so, where I could just get the gist of the timeline, the gist of the issue.
Was the pitch picked up when you were having these phone conversations?
Yeah, so I had the phone conversations as my pre-reporting. So there's like reporting, which is like really in-depth reporting, and then there's pre-reporting, which is like getting enough information to formulate a pitch. So who, what, when, where, and how. A general sense of the character, a general sense of the timeline, a general sense of the science, enough to write like a, I think this pitch was around 800 words, because it needed to show the editors that there's a story here and that there was a good narrative arc. So a narrative arc meaning like, you know, narrative arc of two of the main characters, so one being Dr. Dillis Reyes, which is about her history as, you know, as a scientist, but also as, you know, an immigrant, which I, you know, is very topical, still very topical, working through a medical education system that's very different from the one that she originally trained in, which I find a fascinating topic in general. You know, and then the narrative arc of Connor, which is this kid that was developing normally. His family was very typical American family, and then something happens. And then they go on this journey, and then sort of in the end, it's not that it's a perfect ending, but it's a hopeful ending, and I needed to have enough of that to share with the editors.
And how did you convince the family to let you write about Connor?
I'm very lucky. I don't feel like I had to convince them that hard. I think Connor's mom especially was quite open to it. And I think at that point she had started a Facebook page, so she was very public with his story. I think it would be very different if it was a family that was very private, you know, but they were very public about their story. I think they had raised funds for Connor. So it had gained traction to some degree on social media. It didn't go viral or anything, but it gained some traction. So I didn't feel like they needed a lot of convincing about the story in general, but I think anybody in a position like that needs to be convinced that you're the right person to tell the story. So I had no doubt that they were interested in someone telling their story, but I felt an obligation to share a little bit about myself to give them enough information to decide whether or not they felt I would be the right person to tell the story. And I'm very honored and feel very lucky that they agreed that I was.
Have you ever written about any of your own patients?
I've tried to toe like a sort of safe line with that. I wrote an op-ed for Stat News that was about like one of my research. It's actually a research interest of mine, which is the use of complementary and alternative medicine in pediatrics, like why parents choose different things and what their views are. And so I wrote an op-ed in Stat News a couple of years ago about a patient, and it wasn't just solely about this patient, but the anecdote that I describe is this patient that I saw while I was on call and how he basically had a panic attack. And the night before, he was given Haldol, which is an antipsychotic. And so this time, you know, that was an option, obviously. But, you know, I had a conversation with the parents about whether or not we could try something else as a first line, like something non-invasive, like a very simple relaxation guided imagery technique, and that worked. So it was a very general anecdote, and I didn't use any identifying information. But I think it was important in that case to show that that was an instance that really made me reflect on why we choose the interventions that we choose. And it was really very influential, actually. I mean, it's a very simple, in the broad scheme of things, it was a very simple, discrete episode, you know, but it definitely changed my research interests. It definitely got me thinking about our motivations as physicians in terms of when we choose one thing over another. And sometimes it happens, sometimes it's because of time. Sometimes it's because we're not maybe aware of other techniques and we're not trained in other techniques. It might be pressure from attending physicians or seniors or somebody's parents or what it is. But I felt that it was important for me to bring a bit of that human face to that story to illustrate a broader issue.
And what's kind of the line that physicians must walk when trying to write about their patients?
So I think that's a good question. I think that's one that I recently listened to an interview that Daniel Ofri did with Oliver Sacks. I think it was on YouTube. And she asks this question because, as you know, the late Oliver Sacks, you know, his books were all about different patient cases, right? And we live in a time now where, you know, obviously in the U.S. there's HIPAA. In Canada, where I'm from, there's FIPA. You know, but different regulations around patient privacy and confidentiality. And it's important that those regulations are there. So I think that, I don't think it's black and white. I think that if you're using information that can identify a patient, then I think you need to ask for consent. I think that's very, for me, that's very clear. But if it's a very general enough case where it could really be any patient, I think that maybe you need to be less cautious. But I feel like I go back and forth with this all the time. And that's why I don't write frequently, you know, necessarily about patients that I've seen. And I think every physician writer does this differently. Obviously, I'm very new to this field, but, you know, Danielle Ofri, in her book, she writes about very specific cases. I don't know if she got consent. Same with Atul Gawande, same with Siddhartha Mukherjee. And, you know, these are all people that are frequently writing about this stuff. But I think that we definitely, at this time, we are moving towards making sure that we, you know, we are fair to our patients. Because the other thing is that we don't want, you know, I certainly don't want, you know, the patients that I see to, you know, I don't think I'm necessarily, like, obviously I'm not a well-known name or anything. But, you know, I do write for some relatively large publications, right? So people Google, right? So I wouldn't want a patient to find out, okay, should I tell her this? Because what if she might write about it? And I think that's a very reasonable thing to be concerned about. So I haven't had those conversations yet, but I definitely think that we're at a time where we need to be very forthright.
Also, recently, in this past year, you gave a talk and ran a workshop at Stanford MedX called Think Like a Journalist, The Power of Storytelling in Medicine. So, first of all, how did you get involved in putting together a workshop and a talk?
So, Bon Ku, who's he's an emergency medicine doctor, and he's, I don't remember his exact title, but it's like Associate Dean of Design Thinking or something at Jefferson University. So I actually met him at TEDMed a few years ago and then interviewed him for my first article for the New York Times. And we'd been in touch. And he's amazing. He's someone I would consider a mentor and someone I really respect very highly. Definitely, and I wanted to clarify, I got to know him really well after the New York Times article because generally speaking, like, the ethics of journalism is that you don't write about your friends, you know, because that's PR, right? But I got to know him after that, and he told me, you know, you should start exploring speaking opportunities and this and that, and you've got lots of good ideas. And it was really outside of my comfort zone at that point, but I felt that, you know, why not? Why not just try it? And it seemed like a safe space to do it. So we did a workshop together that was on narrative medicine, And we did it with a really inspiring guy named Adam Hayden, who's a glioblastoma patient and speaker and a whole host of things. And then I also spoke about curiosity in medicine, which is one of many interests of mine. So in that talk, I really talk about why medical education has come to a point where we, unfortunately, for a whole host of reasons, we prevent students from engaging in curiosity. And I think it's a lot like empathy. I think people come in with all these different ideas, and most people in medicine today are not hardcore scientists, right? They're usually what makes some great candidates is because they've got so much more to offer from a humanistic point of view. But something happens in the medical education process, either in medical school or in residency, depending on where you go, where it sort of gets, you know, pushed out of you. And there is this pressure to conform. There's a lot of work and research and interest in this idea of the hidden curriculum, for instance, which is all sort of related to this need to conform. There's certain values, there's a certain cultural, you know, you need to toe the line, that anything that sort of goes outside of that is frowned upon. And I think that's really too bad, because I think what you end up causing is, you know, it's like a factory. It's like, you know, insert one happy, curious, engaged, want to change the world, earnest medical student in year one, and then after medical school or after residency pops out this really burnt out, jaded, angry person. I think we all know that or have been that at some point. And there's good research on empathy showing that people come in wanting to quote unquote help patients. And when they come out of the system, they just want to pay off their loans. They, you know, want to try to have some resemblance of work-life balance, you know, and they're just totally different. I think the same thing happens with curiosity. I think this idea of wonder, you know, just wondering about something, you know, the same type of curiosity that kids have, which is why I love pediatrics so much, is that kids ask all these kinds of questions that I feel as adults we forget. You know, we're almost like blinded by the world, you know, everything around us. We just don't pay attention. We get this tunnel vision almost, which can be helpful. But there is something special about curiosity and wonder, and over time we lose it. And so I think in journalism, it sort of works the opposite way, in that, you know, in order to get a story, in order to get an editor interested in your story, it's got to be different. You know, it has to be, you have to be the opposite of someone that conforms, basically. So I found that really interesting, and I feel like that's what medical education needs today, is initiatives that foster curiosity. In the last couple of years, there's been some really interesting work on this. A couple of people I wanted to highlight. So this pediatrician, he's also the program director of pediatrics at McGill University. His name is Dr. Sternzas, and he studied curiosity. So there hasn't been a lot of research on curiosity in medicine, but he studied it last year, or I should say over the last few years, but he published a paper last year that surveyed medical students. I think it was in first year and in fourth year or something like that. And what they found, what his group found, was interesting. So they found that trait curiosity, so that's this, you know, a trait, so how curious you are just generally by nature.
Right.
So he looked at that, and then he looked at state curiosity. So state curiosity is basically how your curiosity is affected by your environment. So effectively, they concluded that trait curiosity in this group of medical students that they interviewed was quite high, but that state curiosity was lower than expected. So what that basically meant, or how they interpreted that, was that these were very curious medical students, but they didn't feel like they were enriched in their environment. They felt that they had to downplay their curiosity, inquisitiveness, wonder, and that was an issue. And they also found that the trends changed over time as well. And there's another initiative happening at Harvard, actually. So their program director of internal medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital, if I'm not mistaken. It's one of the Harvard hospitals. Just started this pilot program called the Pathways Program. So this is a program that the whole purpose is to encourage curiosity in the residence. So effectively, or I should say, so in Canada, we call everybody residents. In the U.S., I guess, the first year is your intern year, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I'm correct. Okay. So it's really focused on the intern year. And essentially, residents in this program, which is called the Pathways Program, identify a patient, like an interesting patient case, somewhere in the hospital. Usually it's a patient that they might be involved with in terms of their care. But their whole purpose is to try to probe into this medical mystery. So say it's a patient that has a whole host of really unusual symptoms and signs. And that's basically their Pathways project, is to, you know, obviously interview the patient, be involved in their care, but then contact the world experts in whatever disease or condition it may be associated with, and then present in effectively a rounds fashion with, like, you know, 80 physicians later on in the year about this case. So it's a really great opportunity for these interns to take a deep dive into an interesting patient case and really become experts and have the opportunity to speak to, you know, experts all across the world about this rare condition, and then gain a certain level of knowledge where they can speak to established physicians in rounds and really teach them something, I think is really amazing. And it sounds like the program is going to continue. And I think it would be a great model for other schools, other residency programs to think about.
And speaking of curiosity, it seems like the bug hit you a couple of years ago when you co-founded a startup called Kidzee. Basically, it's a children's health platform aimed at bringing accurate information to parents and caregivers. And it was accepted by the University of Toronto's Early Stage Technology Incubator. So can you talk about the project and tell us what happened with it, if it's still happening?
So it failed. But a lot of startups fail, like 90% of startups fail. But it was really fun, and I'm so glad I did it. So effectively, this was an idea that came about when I reflected on the fact that parents often don't have access to great sources of information for their kids' health. So they're getting their information from all over the place, and a lot of it's not accurate. And so I thought about, you know, what if there could be an app that would be personalized? You know, you would plug in your kids' information, their age, their weight, all this kind of stuff. And then it would give personal information that's based on evidence-based guidelines. So American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines, for example. And I founded it with a friend of mine who's an engineer who codes, Adrienne. So we, you know, we took a leap and we bootstrapped, and we had a prototype, and we got accepted into the U of T's Mars incubator. That's what it's called. But the problem is that this is the same problem that a lot of apps run into, is that you need really good market validation. What that means is that it might be a good idea and maybe it makes a difference, but if people don't use it often enough, it's not going to be sustainable. So, you know, we prototyped it, and the parents in our market research group liked the app. It was easy to use, but after the first few weeks that their child was born, for example, first few months, I should say, they felt like they didn't really need to use it as much. So they were really anxious at the beginning, especially first-time parents, and they wanted to have all the information at their fingertips. But then they kind of, you know, they chilled out and they relaxed, or they figured out where they could get their information from, or they spoke to other parents and they didn't use it enough. And I think all of us have done that in terms of downloading an app of some kind, saying, okay, I'm going to do this, or I'm going to track this, or, and then, you know, a few months later, we were like, you know, let's just delete this app. So when it comes to tech, especially the mobile app business, most of us only use, like, on a day-to-day basis, we might use like 5 to 6 apps. And the things that those apps have in common, generally speaking, are that they have a social component. It's not specifically information related. That was the thing that we didn't quite get to. And, you know, I mean, we still own the trademark and it's still company. So the trademark's still there, and maybe it'll be something, you know, I'm not holding my breath, but I'm, you know, it could be. Will it be an app? Definitely not, because I don't think health apps are, you know, and maybe I'll, you know, eat my words in 5 years, but I really don't think health apps are what's going to change things. I think we're really moving beyond that to artificial intelligence, to all these other kinds of things, self-testing of different sorts. but we're not definitely not there with respect to self-testing in terms of validated information, but I think we will get there. And apps, you know, I mean, at the time that we started Kidzee, there were 95,000 apps in the App Store. Now I think there's probably around 300,000 apps because it's much easier to make an app than it was even a couple years ago.
So, like you mentioned, a lot of startups fail, but what did you learn from the process? You know, because I feel like that was probably like a really fruitful.
Yeah, I mean, I loved the process, and I think that was ultimately like something that I loved about journalism too. Is that you're creating something. You know, you're in a space of creating, whereas in medicine, we're usually in a space of absorbing information and trying to apply that information. And a lot of the thought processes that we use are related to how well you can remember something, like memorization or pattern recognition, and maybe a little bit of integration. Like you do, you know, especially as you go on in your training, you learn to integrate information a little bit more and realize when things apply to one patient, maybe not to another. And, you know, I just wrote an article on clinical intuition. So over time, like, you know, kind of how your instinct kind of, you know, plays a role, which is really interesting and fascinating too. But that's very different from creating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very few people in medicine are creating an entirely new thing. That's why we see an entire field of physician entrepreneurs now, right? Or physician podcasters or physician writers or physician
designers,
right? It's because I think at our core nature as human beings, most of us like to create. I mean, think back to kindergarten. I mean, you know, or play school. You're making things out of Play-Doh, right? Or you're making things with Lego, or you're making forts, or you're just making stuff. And then at some point you don't,
mm-hmm.
you know, unless it's for a purpose. Like you might make a quick meal because you need to eat something before you go out the door. I mean, some of us, like, you know, I really like cooking, so I try to be creative in that sense. But generally speaking, as we become adults, we really lose that. And I think that was what I really loved about creating this, is it was literally an idea. And it actually came to me kind of in the middle of the night, and the name sort of came to me. It was very random. And I was like, this is what it's going to be. And me and Adrienne got to talking about it, and she was talking, you know, what it might look like. And we just were like, you know what, let's just try it. It'll probably fail. I mean, and she's a serial entrepreneur, and she's started a bunch of different companies. And so she was very honest with me and said, you know, it's probably going to fail, but let's try it anyway and see how far we get. And we got much further than we thought we would.
Awesome.
And so that was really fun. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Who do you look up to in terms of, like, who are your role models or people you're trying to model your career after,
mm-hmm.
if anyone?
So I think, like, in terms of just role models in general, like, I know everyone says their parents, so, like, it's going to be cliche, but I definitely look up to my parents, especially as, you know, I'm a first-generation immigrant. My parents, you know, are from Sri Lanka. They're both physicians, but they didn't have an easy path, right? As most people that train abroad, especially in medicine, it's not an easy path. But they had a lot of grit and a lot of determination and a lot of drive and focus, and they made sacrifices. And, you know, and it's interesting because a lot of my friends that consider ourselves diaspora, so people that are first generation, you know, from somewhere else. Lately, we've had a lot of these conversations because we're at that age now where our parents immigrated at the same age that we're at right now, you know, and we think about, like, could we do that? Could we leave everything, or like a hot climate or whatever it was, or the language, and then just get up and leave and start
fresh.
From most of us probably couldn't, you know, I mean, we don't, maybe we could, but generally speaking, we just don't know another way of life. So I definitely have a lot of respect and admiration from that for them, and definitely the rules that they put in place when myself and my siblings were younger. I think I didn't always understand it, but I know now, in terms of like focus and drive and putting academics first. I think a lot of families have that similar type of focus, so I definitely admire them. In terms of career wise, I think there's a few different people. I mean, I think from a writing perspective, I really, really enjoy Sarah Stillman's writing. So she writes for The New Yorker, and she studied anthropology before she wrote for the the New Yorker as well. And so what she brings to her stories in terms of the level of cultural competence and the nuance and the empathy, I think, is really unlike 90% of authors and writers, in my opinion. So I really admire her as a writer. In terms of medical-specific physician writers, I think it varies. I think that there's, you know, I really like Siddhartha Mukherjee's New Yorker pieces, especially. He writes for the New Yorker. He also writes for the New York Times Magazine. I really like his New Yorker writing personally because he's able to bring in interesting analogies. I think a lot of his writing brings in, whether it's in The Emperor of All Maladies, where he talks about cancer basically as a patient. I think that's a very unique way to think of the disease. And in a recent New Yorker piece called The Invasion Equation, he brings up his own research, but he really brings up this general topic of thinking about how cancer can exist in the context of an environment. So basically, what are the factors in a patient's physiology, like normal physiology, that allow for cancer to thrive? So whether it's differences in pH, whether it's nutrition, whatever it might be, and then to bring in that, the analogy of one of the Great Lakes and how temperature changes caused the influx of zebra mussels, which was parasitic species, so very similar to how we think about cancer, you know, and then it really leaves the reader by, you know, wondering about, okay, if we think about cancer in this way, how does this change how we might approach treatment? So treatment, instead of just focusing on the cancer, treatment that also looks at the environment, you know, just like in a lake, if you want to get rid of the zebra mussels, you make sure that the lake itself is not hospitable to zebra mussels, right? So I think that his writing is quite profound. I really like Sandeep Jauhar. His book, he's written a few books, but his second book, Doctored, I think is one of the best medical memoirs, I think, in terms of what he talks about and some of the controversies that he touches on. So I think there's a lot of people that I look up to in terms of professionally. But yeah, I think everyone has to find their own path. I think that everyone has their own life story and their own unique challenges. And I think that it's really about trying to find a way to create your own way forward, right? And bring your own unique skills and passions, and also know that those might change over time. You might leave something and come back to it later. And building community. I think that that's one thing that I think as I mature, I think I realize it's probably one of the most important things, is to really cultivate healthy, happy, productive people in your life that can inspire you, but also can challenge you intellectually to think differently about things or, you know, be able to bring their experience to the table where you can be allowed to reflect or revisit some of the things that you might have seen as being true in the past. And I think that that's where really powerful things can happen, is when you really change your perspective.
And what books have made the biggest impact on you?
There's a lot of books that have. I think that, and they're not specifically journalistic types of books, but I think in terms of just life in general, I think A New Earth by Eckhart Tolle, when I read that book, I think that really opened a lot up for me. I think it really made me think about how we view life and how we view attachment and how we have expectations around how life should go and what happens when those expectations are not fulfilled, and whether it's expectations of life, whether it's expectations of a partner or a friend, and what can result from that, and how, you know, in order to live a very balanced life, you can identify that as almost like an observer. So I think that's really powerful. I think Ryan Holiday's work. So I've read some of his stuff. I think I heard about him through Tim Ferriss' podcast. But the whole Stoic philosophy, I mean, it sort of relates to the Eckhart Tolle part, and even though Eckhart Tolle isn't a Stoic per se, but again, it relates to attachment. It relates to how you approach life, how you handle stress, how you handle setbacks, I think is really powerful. I think from a creative point of view, really anything by Adam Grant, his book Givers and Takers and his TED Talk, which is on the same, I think is very profound. I think most of us in medicine can really resonate with a lot of those concepts because most of us are type A. Most of us are used to having to set ourselves apart from the crowd in order to jump through all the hoops that we need to jump through. And because of that, it's very difficult to stay generous because the system is such that it really is, feels like dog eats dog, basically. So that book really gets you to think about the nature of workplace relationships very differently. And I thought that was really powerful. And then his book Original is probably one of my top five favorite books because it talks about the creative process in terms of how people can innovate with it, especially within systems. I think that when we think of innovation, and there's this whole idea of entrepreneurship and intrapreneurship, which I think is valuable. So entrepreneurship being like being an outsider creating something like a startup versus intrapreneurship where you're in an organization like a hospital, for example, that's can be very antiquated in terms of their policies. You know, we know medicine in general, like we need however many randomized control trials before a single guideline is changed, right? So it's not exactly the most innovative system, but how do you make the small changes that can make a big difference? And in his book, he talks about, and he's able to use case studies where he shows that people that really wanted to make a difference, that really wanted to innovate from the inside, were unsuccessful. And he makes a really powerful argument for why you need to have very strong relationships within an organization and the buy-in of the people that matter. So people with status, people with influence, to really make a difference, because otherwise you can't. And there's so many stories out there of people, especially leaders that come in, you know, from outside and come into an organization and try to make all these changes and have all these high hopes and they get hired because of their vision. But at the end of the day, the people in an organization are not willing to change, mm-hmm. then nothing changes.
Right.
So that book was really profound for me. I mean, there's so many books that I revisit often. There's one book that I read recently that I actually found really interesting, and it's a book by Christine Porath, who is a business. She teaches in the business program at George Washington or Georgetown, one of those. And she wrote this book called Mastering Civility. So it's all about how do you create civil workplaces. And again, I think this all relates to sort of some of the ideas that I have percolating right now, which is around learning environments and hospital environments. And her book in general talks about how do you create happy workplaces? Specifically, how do you create workplaces where people treat each other with respect? And that could mean anything from just being inclusive to walking down the hall and making eye contact, mm-hmm. and saying hello, and how that can actually make such a difference in terms of how happy people feel at work. And we know that happy people at work tend to be more productive at work, and they tend to stay in that workplace. So, you know, retention tends to not be an issue in those workplaces. So that's something that gave me a lot of interesting ideas in terms of how we might apply that to hospital and healthcare environments, especially at a time where we're thinking, you know, we're dealing with pressures and burnout and all kinds of things.
Right. That's cool. All right. My reading list is growing now.
Yeah.
What are your next projects?
I am actually writing a piece related to curiosity right now. Actually, I've written it. It just hasn't come out yet. But it goes, you know, it goes a bit more in depth in terms of some of the themes that I talk about in my Stanford talk. And I know that the Stanford MedX talk is not online anywhere. But yeah, so I talk about some of those themes. I'm also thinking a lot about teamwork. We've all been part of dysfunctional teams. And we've all been part of teams that have worked really well together, you know, in healthcare specifically. And so I was thinking a little bit about how do we make that distinction, and can you predict how well a healthcare team will work? And in terms of like outcomes, like, you know, that could mean anything from how good every team member feels at the end of the day, how valued they feel, but also something even bigger, like patient outcomes. Like, can you create an optimum team that optimizes patient satisfaction and, you know, the satisfaction and, you know, how each of the clinicians on the team feel. So I haven't quite found the edge on that yet, but I think that there's some really interesting literature from the business world on that. So that's definitely what I'm working on as well. And I am going to be working on a book. It's very early on right now, and I have an agent, but it's very, very early stages, and I'm trying to find that edge of, you know, I don't want to write like a, I think I've read some really great medical memoirs, but I feel like I want to write something that goes into it in a bit of a different way. So I have to figure that out. Yeah. Another thing that I'm working on is trying to figure out. So in my clinical practice, what I'd like to do, you know, at the end, I mean, I don't know what my career is going to look like in the end in terms of the proportion of clinical work I'll do and journalism and other projects, but definitely from a clinical point of view, I want to be able to blend pediatrics, like traditional, typical general pediatrics, with evidence-based modalities from other disciplines. So specifically related to like stress reduction and addressing stress and anxiety and depression in children and teens, and the different ways that we can do that, and some which involves medication, some which doesn't, but ways that we can equip children early on to have the tools they need to optimize their health and well-being. So from a clinical point of view, that's what I'd like to do. And so a friend of mine who's an internist is doing that from an adult medicine point of view. So we're talking about ways that we can collaborate through videos or through other kinds of projects to put our heads together, basically, around that.
And where can people find you?
So my website is basically just Contently. So I have a link on my Twitter. So Twitter is probably the best way. And there's a link to my Contently site, which is just a portfolio of my work. There isn't really much else out there. I'll have a website at some point, but I haven't really gotten around to it yet.
Right. And also on the Dr. Hustle website, where we have the show notes, we'll also have links to all your articles, to your Twitter account.
Oh, great.
So that's like another place that people can find pretty much all the stuff you do.
Okay.
Spot.
Perfect.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Adam Grant, the author of Give and Take, wrote, "This is what I find most magnetic about successful givers. They get to the top without cutting others down, finding ways of expanding the pie that benefit themselves and the people around them. Whereas success is zero sum in a group of takers, in a group of givers, it may be true that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts." There we go, listeners. The world does not have to be a zero-sum game. There's an opportunity for all of us to succeed. And if we can approach the generosity of today's guests, there might be hope for us after all.
For more information about Dr. Hustle, to view today's show notes, or to contact Bassam, visit drhustle.com. If you want others to know about this podcast, please write a review at the podcast store, and please link to us on social media at Dr_Hustle on Twitter and at Dr.Hustle on Instagram. This podcast is produced by Bassam Zahid, whose other work can be found at bassamzahid.com. Thanks for listening.